Okay, so we're starting this morning with eyeball, so paper series 14, and I'm handing over to Rhianna.
Thank you. So we've got quite a few papers for you today to go through, but we've kept them all to 10 pages or less, so at least hopefully that will help to ease the burden. This paper, paper 14A, that we want to discuss is just the sweep issue that relates to the discussion we've had in October. So in that meeting, the board discussed what kind of modifications or changes to contracts and cash flows should qualify as a modification under IFRS 9, and then to which we should apply the practical expedient. And in that discussion, the board noted that there's a slight inconsistency in the wording used in IFRS 9 when it talks about financial liabilities, where there's changes in the terms of the liability versus financial assets, which talks about there's a change in the contractual cash flows of the asset. And because of that inconsistency, or the difference in wording really, and to avoid any diversity in practice, the board tentatively decided to make a change to the permanent text of IFRS 9. So it's not, that decision was not just limited to the IBOR changes only. It was to make the change to the permanent text of IFRS 9. Now, subsequent to that meeting, when we started working on the exposure draft and the drafting and the structure of the exposure draft, the staff realized that we might need a bit more time just to make sure we get the drafting of that paragraph or paragraphs and the location within the standard right. And given the short amount of time we have, that we want to try and get this exposure draft out, we are therefore asking you whether we could limit the scope of that change for now just to the IBOR changes, and then once the IBOR project is done, we will come back and look at a broader change to IFRS 9 in this regard. So I think that just takes us to the question whether you agree with our recommendation to limit the scope of this change for the purpose of the exposure draft now, and then we'll come back later with a separate change to IFRS 9.
Anne? Yes, I do agree with what the staff are proposing. It seems eminently sensible to me. You've been concerned as you entered the drafting that there could be wider things. You just need a little bit more time, and we all know that we're under a lot of time pressure on this. So I think what you're proposing in this paper is the right way for us to go ahead, so I do support.
Rika? I also support recommendation, because after the board meeting, I received the feedback and some questions about if the ISB can sufficient and the salary assess the effect of these changes, if that is applied throughout the IFRS 9 in a very short period. So I think this is a reasonable sense to make a decision.
Thank you. Jin Cha?
I also agree with staff's proposal that is two-steps approach. I think it's a practical solution. Just one clarification on the meaning of the changes made in context of IBOR reform. What's the meaning of the changes? Just the clarification whether that's changes made in the context of the IBOR reform, including both, that is not only limited to the to the changes of contractual terms and contract cash flows, but also include the change in the basis on which contractual cash flow were determined.
Yes.
Both, yeah.
Yes. So it's the clarification that a modification is not just a change in the terms,
yeah.
It is when you change the basis on which the cash flows are being calculated, which is different from what you've originally anticipated they would be based on.
I also agree with the staff recommendation. I, based on conversations I've had with people, I still struggle to see the cause of some of the concerns that are coming up in terms of this proposed change in the broader context. Having said that, I think we do need to be careful to make sure that we're very clear what's included and what's not included, because there could be some very simple changes in calculation methodologies from, I don't know, 30, you know, calendar days to 30 days and things like that that maybe we don't want to sweep in. And so I think we need to be, it's going to take quite precise drafting, and so if we've got more time to do it, I think that is a good thing. But I hope that people don't take this as the first step of us backing away from this concept, because I think it is very important in the context of IBOR reform to have clarity around this point on the changes in the calculations. So by sort of narrowing its scope doesn't mean I, for one, am going off the idea. I think it's really important. I think it's important in the context of Eonia. I also saw some press coverage this week talking about the possibility of there being this concept of synthetic LIBOR coming into the market to try and deal with cases where it may not be possible to actually amend contracts, which would suggest that there may be more circumstances where the words in the contract don't change, but the mechanisms are changed by sort of external legislative forces, etc. And so I think it could become more important than it even is now. But I do agree that focusing it for now on the reform is a sensible approach from a process and also a safety perspective. Can I get a show of hands on question one?
13, one absent.
The next paper, agenda paper 40B, deals with the separately identifiable requirements for when you want to hedge a risk component. So, and specifically, we are looking at those risk components that are not contractually specified in the contract, and therefore you need to meet the requirements in both IAS 39 and IFRS 9 that this risk component is separately identifiable and reliably measured. Now, the board also discussed this as part of the phase one amendments. And specifically in the February 2019 meeting, the board discussed the separately identifiable criteria and the interaction it has with, to have something that is reliably measurable, you need something that is separately identifiable and vice versa. If you don't have something that's separately identifiable, it sort of begs the question, how are you measuring that component? So for the phase one relief that was published in September last year, we started off with rates that have met the criteria both at designation of the hedge and continuous over the life of the hedge, right up until the point where the phase one exceptions kicked in, and then entities were no longer required to test it on an ongoing basis. So for those hedges, they could just assume that it remains separately identifiable. But the big thing was it started with a rate that did meet the criteria, and then we said you don't need to meet it further on. Under the phase two amendments and as the transition to the alternative benchmark rates progress, these new alternative benchmark rates have not been designated in a hedging relationship yet as the risk component, so they haven't met the separately identifiable criteria yet. And there were concerns expressed that in some circumstances, these rates would not be able to meet the criteria because there's not sufficient liquidity yet in the market to show that these rates are really the way that the loans and the debt instruments will be priced going forward. But it's, in most cases, I'm hoping, it's a timing matter that as the transition progresses and as more entities transition, the liquidity will build up and these rates would become the separately identifiable component, but not as yet. And we've also heard some concerns that because of the accounting limitations and the fact that entities think they or at the moment don't see how to designate these alternative benchmark rates as the risk component, it stops them progressing the transition. So they don't want to progress the transition because they can't designate the hedges. And so to help in that regard and not be the burden or the obstacle to transition, we have recommended in that agenda paper that if there's a risk component that the entity has a reasonable expectation that it would be separately identifiable within 12 months of designating that hedge and it is reliably measurable, that that should qualify for hedge accounting, you know, at the date that you make the change. So we sort of give them a 12-month window to meet the requirements. But then, of course, if after the 12 months it still doesn't meet the requirements, then the hedge would be discontinued. So I will open for discussion.
So just a couple of comments and maybe just a few reactions to some of the feedback that I've heard coming from people in the market who have looked at this paper and maybe aren't so keen on this proposal. So overall, I do support the staff recommendation. I think it is really important, the separately identifiable criteria. So I think providing relief is a useful and helpful thing to do, but it's not something we should do lightly. So I think the focus on it is important. And I've heard a few people, I've been trying to work out why people are sort of, I thought they'd quite like this and they don't seem to like it as much as I expected. So I've been trying to understand where the tensions seem to be. So a couple of comments on that. So I think some people see this as being inconsistent with phase one, because in phase one, we basically said you could just sort of assume everything was okay, whereas here we're saying you have to make these assessments, and if it's not okay after 12 months, then you have to stop hedge accounting. So they see an inconsistency between those two things. But I look at it differently, because as you pointed out in your tee-up, the relief we provided in phase one was only for hedges where originally they did meet the separately identifiable criteria. And if you think about what I thought we were trying to achieve in phase one, we were trying to prevent existing hedges from being disrupted just because of what's going on with IBOR. So that was a hedge that had been okay, and we wanted to allow them to continue. At the moment, as I understand it, if you were starting with a new hedge, you need to meet the separately identifiable criteria. So if you're starting off now without the relief we're proposing, my understanding is you can't start the new hedge. So this is an additional relief over and above what we provided in phase one. I think it's one we need to provide, and it's to facilitate new hedges being put in place, but we're in a completely different starting position to the ones we dealt with in phase one, because at some point in time, separately identifiable had been met, whereas here we're dealing with situations where it's not. So it's a different population, and I think a different objective that we're trying to deal with. So I don't see the disconnect some people are seeing between those two things. And I think for us, to give relief on separately identifiable is a big deal. It's not the same as reliably measurable. Some people would like to say, as long as it's reliably measurable, why are you so fussed on separately identifiable? But they're two distinct tests. I think one other thing, though, that people maybe are worrying about is that 12 months might not be enough. So they may be able to start off and they may be able to apply judgment and conclude that it's reasonably likely to meet the criteria. There's a reasonable expectation that it will be separately identifiable within 12 months. And that may not be long enough given the amount of uncertainty that's still in the market. We just made 12 months up. The staff have just made 12 months up and they've got reasonable, you know, criteria for how they made it up. But at the end of the day, it's arbitrary. So if one of the concerns people have is that the market may need more than 12 months to settle, personally, I'd be comfortable to give, say, 24 months. So what you've recommended, but with a 24-month window, which means that people have got a greater level of assurance that it will come right in time for that hedge to continue past this relief date. So I'd be amenable to that as a tweak to the staff recommendation.
I just want to, maybe just for the sake of clarity, this issue about the separately identifiable risk for it is definitely for new hedges, but it's also for these hedges coming out of phase one where we are changing the risk, and at that point we're saying you have to meet the criteria. So it's not necessarily a new hedge at that point, it's the continuation of the previous hedge, but you have to meet all the criteria as we've said in previous meetings. And so it sort of interplays with the phase one end of relief, which seemed to have said, you know, it never ends. But in this case, really, when you change the risk, it has to end the phase one relief and you have to go over to phase two and apply the criteria.
And just to confirm one thing, this 12-month, square bracket, 12-month test that we have in here for the relief, it starts from when each entity is starting a particular hedge. Yes. It's not a fixed 12 months, so people who take longer or short, it'll be sort of different 12 months for different people. Yeah. And different hedges, actually. Yeah. Different hedges. Darrell?
So first a question. What actually happens if you get to the end? By the way, I agree with what Sue said. I'd probably also be comfortable with the longer period. What happens at the end of the 12 months or the 24 months if you have not met the criteria? Do you fail the hedge at that point and do whatever you would do with a normal failure, or do you reverse the fact that you even had a hedge in the first place?
No, you just continue the hedge at that point and you stop applying hedge.
And then if subsequently satisfy the criteria, can you restart the hedge from that advanced point but subject to effectiveness?
Yeah, you can always. If you meet the hedge counting criteria, you can restart another hedge or that same hedge using the same instruments, but
it's always noise, of course. But
yeah. And then the idea, just to just get this right in my head, the separately identifiable thing is what you would essentially be doing is you would be assuming you have a separately identifiable thing and then basing your measurement requirements off that assumed outcome.
Yes. Not just assuming. You have to be satisfied.
Satisfied. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, yes.
And the measurement is, I think, one of the other criteria we've added is that, yes, there needs to be a reasonable expectation that this rate you are using will become separately identifiable or meet the criteria within that period. But also during that period, it still needs to be reliably measurable. So, because if we can't measure it...
Then there's no... Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Thank you. Rika?
Thank you, Sue. I think I support staff recommendation. So in most cases, I thought providing 12-month release will be workable or in the market structure. But at the same time, I assume that there are various different market structure in the world, and there might be a risk to fail satisfying the criteria at the end of these 12 months. So I truly think because of that, maybe the speed of the how to transfer the, how mature the market will become is depending on the jurisdiction situation. So some market will develop the new reference market very quickly and re-establish the same as what we have now, but the other market might not be able to do that in the same way and same speed. So even though we finalize this based on the 12-month period, still I think we need to get the feedback from the various stakeholders from the different market. And I hope the staff consider that point seriously to take into consideration for further the assessment.
Today.
Thank you, Sue. Yeah, it's much more a practical question. When you say that they reasonably expect, how is supposed that management would demonstrate this based on what kind of information that they are reasonably expecting that in 12 months that will be achieving the requirements in IFRS 9, IFRS 39?
I think it is, it's judgment like it is with a lot of other things, but that judgment would need to take into account what is the progress within that jurisdiction in transitioning to the rates. What is the liquidity both in the debt instrument and the derivative markets, and where is the market going? Because at the moment we have this strange situation where LIBOR is sort of globally an accepted benchmark rate, whereas I think the way we are moving with some of these other alternative rates that it becoming more jurisdiction specific, and it might not be that global accepted. So it will depend on each jurisdiction and the market structure within that jurisdiction whether they would consider that rate or at which point they consider a rate to be separately meeting the criteria to be separately identifiable. So in other words, how are the loans being priced, the variable rate loans are being priced in that market, if there are bonds,
how much assurance is there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tom?
I have a question, maybe a comment after, but So the entity at the beginning reasonably expects. What happens if at some point prior to 12 months it no longer reasonably expects? It's pretty sure it's not going to become separately identifiable. And like at that point, and then throughout we've sort of always said everything had to be, you know, sort of everybody had to do it the same way. So at that point, are they allowed to derecognize then, or are they forced to wait the 12 months?
No, they would be required at the point where you no longer have the expectation that it will be separately identifiable in that 12-month period, you would have to discontinue the hedging relationship.
Because a lot of times we made sure that people couldn't sort of choose. And if there's a lot of judgment, and I might decide this is a good time. So that's a risk we just got to live with, because I think the way you phrased it, if I said I no longer reasonably expect, then clearly I'm out of bounds. Okay. And so my comment then on that might be that might be another good reason for 24 months. Because the reasonable expectation is likely to hold more solidly with 24 months, and I'm not necessarily that keen on people popping out at 6 months.
Jing Chao?
Thank you. Basically, I agree with staff's proposal. I think we should give some practical relief for address this situation, because otherwise, maybe for existing hedging relationship, they have to discontinue that hedging relationship, and they will not faithfully represent their risk management strategy. One question I have is that, as you mentioned, because this practical relief will apply to both existing hedging relationship as well as new hedging relationship. So maybe different hedging relationship, the time they need is different. For example, because how we calculated 12 months, it starts from that component was designated. So for example, for new hedging relationship, the date may be the components of that risk components was dated maybe first quarter of next year. So and maybe they only need a very short time period, because once they designated new hedging relationship later, the new alternative, rate will be available very quickly. But for existing hedging relationship, because we're calculating starting from that risk component was designated. So maybe it was designated, several months ago, maybe many years ago, something like that. So I think the calculation starting from that risk component was designated. Is practical for those existing, hedging relationship?
It's existing and not modified. It's not tested because of phase one.
Yeah, existing and modified. Existed to benchmark.
But if you have an existing relationship, it will only apply to that relationship once you change the hedge risk. So you move out of the phase one relief. You change the hedge risk to becoming this new RFR rate, and 12 months from that date onwards, you would apply the separate clearing, this relief to that new risk. It won't be backdated to the beginning of the old hedge, because we've changed the risk.
Because for phase one, we said you could just continue to have the relief for as long as that hedge was in place.
So that's this phase one is gone. So it's starting from new start. So I think it's better to clarify when it should be started, to calculate 12-month period, yeah.
Okay. Mary?
Apologies, I feel like I'm a bit of a Grinch with my comments here, but I have some real concern about us offering this relief at all, and certainly about us offering it for an extended period of time, because the issue that we're dealing with is a market structure issue. You know, has the market developed well enough? And just stepping back from this, it's remembering, we have the separately identifiable and reliably measurable criteria in the hedge accounting requirements to say, in the circumstance when you don't have a contractually specified risk, here are the screening criteria that we have for you to be able to hedge this. And I really worry that we're going down the route of using accounting, in this case qualifying for hedge accounting, as kind of an accounting subsidy to support a market structure policy objective, of transitioning, taking off some of the cost, in this case the accounting cost, of moving to a new rate. And when I step back and think about it, the role of financial reporting is to say what has happened in the period, and if the change because of the move in reference rates means that you've moved to using an instrument that has less liquid markets, why are we not telling users of financial statements about that fact? Now, I see why the staff has raised it. I think it's a good thing to think about, and I can almost maybe see a brief period in the sense of going back to the overall objective about temporary turmoil, in a marketplace leading to discontinuances that wouldn't always happen. And I was feeling like 12 months was a really long stretch to get there, so I'm particularly concerned about already starting to talk about how long should that be. So overall, I have some quite substantial concerns about doing this at all, because it seems to say that those criteria don't really matter. They're not an important discipline, and that is the role of accounting to sometimes encourage certain behaviors or to underwrite bigger policy objectives, and I don't think that's our role, and I don't think we should get into it.
Gary?
Thank you. Well, unlike my friend Mary, I have no concerns. Yes. But my first question was, which got answered, what's the basis for 12 months? And I'm listening to it as I'm in paragraph 24. I'm coming around to 24 might be a much better answer for a variety of reasons. We should dissect paragraph 24. Go through it. Phase 2, the third quarter 2020. 12 months brings you basically the fourth quarter 2021. I mean, it's hard enough closing the books as it is, and the last thing you need to be dealing with is what is the implications of this. That's a concern. And as I go through it, right, this is, we'll be close to the general target. Well, close is not there, it's close, and it's not necessarily beyond. And then you go a little bit further on, we'll be close to the general target date for some interest rate benchmarks. Well, some is not all. And so I need to kind of step back through there. 12 months is not really a whole long period of time. And I think 24 makes a lot more sense when you start looking at, okay, I agree it's arbitrary, it's going to be lying in the sand, but you're not, 12 months from now, as I read this paragraph literally, for the most part, the world isn't there yet, but we're doing this as a practical expedient to help the world. All market participants want this IBOR reform to work. It's not like different constituents and sectors are working across purposes. Everyone wants this thing to work, and I think we've taken the general view is that we understand there's dislocation, we understand there's transitional barriers, we're going to not get in the way, because everyone wants hedges to be effective, at least hedges in the scope. Everyone accepts there's a lot of work and challenges to flip from where we are to where you want to be. But still, the overarching goal is people want hedges to be effective. And I think almost this entire project is about sort of facilitate that, not to be unusually in the way. And I think the staff's recommendation is right on. We should do this. This thing, 12 months is going to go by really fast. And I think 24 months makes a whole lot more sense. Even if we didn't want to go that far, I would say not effective before Q1 2022. It's like 15, 18 months or something, just to get it out of the 2021 close cycle. But 24 months, I don't see what harm is done in going that far out.
Of course, if somebody was starting a new hedge halfway through 2020, their 12 months would start from them.
Yes.
Yeah. Daryl?
So I'm still comfortable with the direction we're taking, and I think perhaps to Mary's comment and to confirm something, What this would allow people to do is to get into hedge accounting. To the extent that there is ineffectiveness because of the uncertainty in the market, they would live with that ineffectiveness in their profit and loss. So you're going to see that volatility will come through to a large extent. And it just seems to me, if I think about what the objective of the project was, is to try to smooth the process, if you like. I think I'm comfortable with that outcome. I often have debates with people about how we use words in meetings, and I think I'm about to walk into one of those wordy traps. the point that Tom raised actually gave me a little bit of pause for concern, and I think there's probably two problems with it. The first is the one that Tom raised, which is this idea that if I'm do I essentially have a little bit of a leeway with this reasonably certain so that I can decide when to end something? I think the second part of it is actually that constant reassessment. If I'm slightly less reasonably certain, what does that mean? And I just wondered if staff had thought about turning the subsequent test the other way. So in order to get in, you need to be reasonably certain that this will go right. In order to get out, you need to be reasonably certain that you will fail the test. So in other words, it just puts a greater emphasis on the move between the decision. It makes it harder to get out than it was to get in the first place.
Or even sense. That you can... Well, I won't say that.
It just feels to me like that might take some of the pressure off the need to be constantly assessing how reasonably certain you are, because there's that bigger gap. And to Tom's point, it might make it a little bit harder to just voluntarily decide, okay, I'm now reasonably certain it's not the case.
And so you're sort of thinking about it that there's quite a high hurdle to come into this, because you need to be reasonably certain, but then you can't just drop out when you want to.
There's quite a high hurdle to get out again, if that makes sense.
I hesitated, but I will say it might be. You can tell me.
Yeah.
I won't punch you if it's the worst idea in the world. But whether it would just be easier to say you have to be reasonably certain to get in, but we won't make you reassess that at all until you get to the square brackets 12 months. It's like you have to check to get in, but after that you have to meet all of the normal criteria except this one. We'll just leave you in peace until you get to the end of the 12 months.
So that picks up the one thing, not having to reassess, but does it pick up the Tom's problem? So would you say not only do you not have to, you're not allowed to. So you essentially only reassess once at, let's say, the 12-month mark.
Although let's not forget that most of these guys are in 39. They can decide to stop hedge accounting.
So like Daryl, I'm also looking at the words, but perhaps more from a layperson point of view. And I'm still struggling to reconcile the staff recommendation with particularly paragraph 17. And the sentence in paragraph 17, it is difficult to reliably measure a component that cannot be separately identified. And it's the interplay between those. I mean, it seems to suggest then that in terms of the recommendation, it's a very small window that opens. Or are we just sort of turning not a blind eye, but I struggle with the conclusion with what's said in paragraph 17.
I understand the concept. In a way, this is similar to what we've said in phase one as well, is where we said, well, yes, your risk may no longer be separately identifiable. We're just not going to force you to test it. But you still have to measure it, and you still have to book the ineffectiveness.
It still has to be reliably measurable.
Yes.
So we separated the two in phase one, so I think we're doing the same here. I think my thinking is that there is a relationship between the two. So I think it is possible that because it's not separately identifiable, it may be harder for you to get comfortable that it's reliably measurable. So I think we're giving on one, but it's not a free pass, because I think the reliably measurable assessment could be tougher in those circumstances. Okay, shall we take a vote on question one? Should I take a vote first with 12 months?
Yes.
And then I'll take a vote with 24 months.
And changing the exit criteria or not?
Would you be okay to not be required to do that reassessment until the end of the period?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Even if it's required or permitted, this market will never be illiquid.
Still has to be reliably measurable.
And
well,
to get in
phase one, we've let them do that.
But to get in, you still need to think that it is reasonably expected. So you can't get in without at least having that expectation that it will happen. Over what period of time, it depends, but if I think if you're in a market where you don't know which rate or if there is a benchmark rate that will become that will meet the criteria, then I don't think you would change your hedge risk in any case.
My point is only if maybe shortly before year end, maybe some the developments that the regulators say this will not work, we go to a different thing. And if we have this 12 months and still in, it's not reflected. Still.
Do you want to respond or shall I let this go on? Tom?
Yeah, I like the simplicity of the you're in and you never look again, but I am worried that there might be circumstances where we would want them. Like, I can't think of, if you think of every possible thing, would you really always want, I think this may be consistent with what Martin said, would you really always want them to carry on with the thing, especially when you've got year ends popping up or quarter ends? In some sense, Daryl's is a nice intermediate position between the two. I also think they're a little bit linked. If we did put the you don't do anything till at least 12 months, then I'd be a little more worried about making it 24. So these things are not totally unrelated. So I just, when we get to voting, if we could just be really clear on what we're voting.
Well, I was going to sort of clarify what we were going to vote on, but then Daryl asked the question, so I stopped mid-stride. Daryl, do you want to?
I was just going to say, I think Martin's comment has got me back to agreeing with Tom, agreeing with me.
Which is?
Which is the reasonably certain test at the beginning, being reasonably certain it will become separately identifiable, and then subsequently the test is, are you reasonably certain it's not going to be separately identifiable? Because I think that answers Martin's question.
All right, so let's vote with that amendment and for a 12-month period. That will be the first vote I will call, and then the second vote I will call will be with that same amendment, but with 24 months. So can I get a show of hands first with 12 months?
Four in favour.
Okay, with 24 months.
10 in favour.
No, one absent.
There'll be 10.
Well, somebody might have voted twice.
I voted twice.
Okay. Yeah.
You could vote twice.
Okay. Okay.
It's resolved. Thank goodness there's only 13 of us in the room. Not that Hans is away, but that we don't have more to deal with, just to be clear.
Vote in, vote often.
Okay, good. All right, okay. Moving on.
14C. Okay, so agenda paper 14C discusses the end of application for the proposed amendments in phase two and whether those amendments should be applied mandatorily or an entity should have a choice in applying them. So starting with end of application, the staff note that the application of the proposed amendments in phase two is associated with the point at which transition to an alternative benchmark rate occurs, and hence by design, the application of these amendments has a limited life and a natural end of application. So in other words, the nature of phase two amendments is such that an entity applies the proposed amendments to financial instruments upon modification to transition from interest rate benchmarks to alternative benchmark rates, including when making the changes to hedging relationships and the related hedge documentation necessary to reflect modifications required as a direct consequence of the reform. And as such, we think the entity should not apply the proposed amendments continuously after a financial instrument has transitioned to an alternative benchmark rate. The staff analysis about the end of application for the proposed amendments is set out in paragraphs 11 to 23 of the paper. Now I'll pause and direct your attention to question 1 in page 6, which asks the board whether you agree with this staff analysis.
It's just a comment on paragraph 21B on page 6 of where the question is. They say that the entities transition to alternative benchmark for all financial instruments. I think that disclosure would be required when it still has some relevance. all? Because if there is just, for example, one instrument or something like that, it's still open. Maybe it's just much more a matter of wording than instead of all.
I wondered whether we needed to be so specific in terms of this sort of application once idea. I agree that we should only be allowing this relief for things that are directly arising from the reform. But if I think about, my concern is I think different markets are doing different things and probably different entities will do different things in response to the reform, and they may be doing things which are perfectly legitimate in response to the reform, and I don't want to sort of unduly restrict the relief. And the example that came to mind was actually in the context of Eonia. So I think with our clarification, or sorry, with our change to say that a change in the calculation methodology is a modification, if somebody's got a relatively long-dated Eonia instrument, as I understand it, they've already had one modification event that occurred when they were changed to a calculation that is ESTA plus 8.5 basis points, so that's modification one. Because it's long dated, ultimately I think the idea is that they will actually need to change the words in the contract to refer to ESTA plus. So there'll be two steps in the process, both because of reform, but I think we'd want them to do that modification analysis that we're introducing. I had thought we'd do it twice, and so we can't really say once. And I wonder whether people might, for similar reasons or slightly different reasons, do that with hedge accounting as well. So I wonder whether if we're precise enough and confident enough that we're clear that it has to be as a direct consequence of reform, whether we need to have this, it can only happen once, type of criteria. Martin?
Yeah, one question, man. And this is what we just discussed in paper B. Man, when will that end? Is that an entity maybe in the year 2030 comes off the idea this after the market maybe has already established, and they I'm now for a new hedge first time apply this new designation, this new benchmark rate, and they still have this 2-year relief then? Yeah. Well, because I think we need an end for that. Otherwise,
can
people
hedges,
will.
Can you have?
But my understanding is in 22 we will not have an end, or is it? Maybe I misunderstood. Do we have an end for that, or? Because I read 22 that an end is not needed.
Is the idea that the relief that we've just been discussing is from uncertainty arising as a direct result of IBOR reform? So it's sort of the constraint is on the front end?
In paragraph 23, we sort of say that the proposal for the separately identifiable requirement will cease to apply after that period ends.
But I think Martin's question is, if it's 2030, can you still argue that it's not separately identifiable and you've got 24 months to...
But I think that would, for you to be able to do that, you would have to say that your whatever IBOR rate is still reliably measurable and meeting the criteria, which, you know, maybe for a year or two it might be, but it will fail at some point. So I think there will be a natural push out of phase one to get you into the phase.
You also said it is for newly, new hedges. That's it. And first time you have a new hedge with a new benchmark, and that could be happen in 2030, because maybe that is a new hedge with a new benchmark. And
but can we not write it as if you're not able to determine, that this whole idea of this reasonable certainty assessment for separately identifiable applies where there's uncertainty because of IBOR reform?
Something like that.
So there'd be a gate coming in.
Yes. Yeah, you can't come in 8 years down the line.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's the design.
Yeah.
But I think we'd need to be explicit on that. Daryl?
I was just going to say, I think because it's happening in a staggered way,
I don't think we can put a sort of a termination date and say you can't do it after, because there may well be jurisdictions that are doing this very late.
Yes,
but if I remember, we had a reference in the phase one directly to the paper that launched the IBOR reform process. So we have very carefully identified exactly what the cause is. And I think then to the discussion that you've just had, to just link this back to that cause means, I think, this becomes very hard to come in, as you say, 8 years down the line. Yeah.
Mary?
Well, just kind of piling on what Daryl said, I mean, I've been imagining these amendments, the CD, structured in the same way as phase one, in terms of there's a separate section that goes in that says, if you are within the scope, and as Daryl said, you know, phase one, not only referred to that FSB paper, but it goes back to the idea of, our definition of a necessary change that gives economic equivalence in the context of IBOR reform, rather than just for any hedge you have from now into perpetuity, thinking about that last issue. If you have some current lack of liquidity in the marketplace, you can think about applying this. And it really is, one of the upsides of that first issue you discussed with us, the sweep issue, is that, that this is all within the package of IBOR reform, and so a segregated section of the standard.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. We can take both questions, yeah? Or you're going to talk about mandatory next?
I was going to do the questions, but...
Are we going to tee up on voluntary mandatory?
Yes.
No. Yes. So we vote on question one first.
Yeah.
So can I get a vote on question one with the addition of making it clear that the separately identifiable relief is linked directly to...
And you have to amend 23, paragraph 23?
I think that follows naturally, but yes. So, okay, show of hands for question one.
13, one absent.
Okay, So moving on the part of the paper that discusses voluntary versus mandatory application. Mm-hmm. Consistent to phase one amendments, the staff is of the view that phase two amendments should also apply mandatorily. This is because voluntary application could lead to selective application of the proposed amendments to some financial instruments but not others, or could apply to some areas included in the scope of the proposed amendments but not to other areas. However, to this point, the staff note that the areas addressed in the board's proposals for phase two are to a large extent linked to one another, and hence they need to apply consistently. Furthermore, a choice of applying the proposed amendments, among other consequences, would distort the usefulness of information to users of financial statements about the effects of IBOR reform, will reduce comparability of financial statements, and as such would be inconsistent with the objective of phase two. So for the reasons summarized above, the staff recommend that the proposed amendments for phase two should apply mandatorily. Hence question two in page 10 asks the board whether you agree with this staff recommendation.
Just a show of hands for question two.
13, one absent.
Agenda paper 14D. This paper discusses the effective date and transition requirements for the board's proposed amendments in phase two. Starting with the effective date, so against the market developments with respect to IBOR reform, stakeholders have continuously emphasized to the board the importance for these amendments to be available as soon as possible. In light of this urgency, the staff are of the view that the board should make the proposed amendments available as soon as possible to allow entities to apply these amendments to financial reporting issues that arise when an entity transitions to alternative benchmark rates. For this purpose, the staff recommend that the effective date should be for annual periods beginning on or after January 1, 2021, and that the earlier application should be permitted. With that, I'll turn your attention to question one in page four, which asks the board whether you agree with this proposal for effective date.
Show of hands, question one.
13, one absent.
Okay. So continuing with transition requirement. Now, As a reminder, phase one amendments were applied retrospectively to those hedging relationships that existed at the beginning of the reporting period in which an entity first applied those amendments or hedging relationships that were designated thereafter. However, at that time, the board noted that the retrospective application would not allow reinstating hedging relationships that have already been discontinued at the date the amendment, the phase one amendments are applied, nor it would allow designation of hedging relationships in hindsight. This is because doing otherwise would be inconsistent with the requirements that hedge accounting applies prospectively. Now, for phase two, against this background, the staff first considered whether the phase two amendments should be applied retrospectively in a way that is consistent with the transition requirements in IFRS 9, including those I just described for phase one amendments. That is, that the amendments would not be applied to financial instruments that have been derecognized at the date of the initial application. In contemplating about this issue, the staff separately considered the accounting outcome that would result by applying such a transition approach to hedging relationships that might have been discontinued solely due to changes in hedging relationships and the related documentation necessary to reflect the modifications required as a direct consequence of the reform before an entity initially applied the phase two amendments. So for the reasons we describe in the paper in paragraph 24, the staff concluded that such an accounting outcome may not provide useful information to users of financial statements and could be regarded as somewhat punitive to preparers that affected the reform before the initial application of phase two amendments. To address this issue, the staff then considered whether the retrospective application of the phase two amendments should also require hedging relationships that have been discontinued before the effective date to be reinstated. So those hedging relationships that have been discontinued solely due to changes required as a direct consequence of the reform. This approach would assist entities in avoiding situations whereby hedging relationships are required to be permanently discontinued due to changes as a required as a direct consequence of the reform, and that discontinuation would result in recognition of gains or losses in the financial statements that would not be reflective of the economic effects of those relationships. So for the avoidance of doubt, the staff highlight that that reinstatement of hedging relationships would be limited to those hedging relationships where an entity is able to demonstrate that if the proposed amendments were available at that time, the hedging relationships would not have been discontinued, and that reinstatement can be done without the use of hindsight. So this brings me to question two in page 10, asking the board whether you agree with the staff recommendation in paragraph 30 to 31 of the paper.
Mary?
I'm afraid it's the Grinch again coming in. But I, thinking about this, and in particular the issue of reinstating hedges that had been discontinued, I have a concern about crossing back to previous annual periods. And, you know, thinking about the effective date, you know, that we're planning for 2021, and the availability for early application, which I assume would be in 2020, you know, I can see allowing, thinking about an entity that is early adopting this amendment, these amendments, being able to restate previously issued interim financial statements to reinstate hedges that had been discontinued since the beginning of the annual period in which the amendment was adopted. So let's say had been discontinued during 2020 itself. But I do have concern, a higher level of concern about restating previous annual periods that have been released, you know, and presumably this discontinuance explained, to go back beyond that beginning of the period. I guess that would mean for an entity that elected not to early adopt, that they would know that they were kind of giving up, and there's some giving up that relief, and there's some tension with, you know, the point that you raised, Lyra, about the usefulness of the information about discontinuance. But I just think, going back in terms of earlier annual periods, that's more problematic than interim financial reporting. So I think I would accept the ability to reinstate, but I would just go back to the beginning of the annual period in which the amendment is adopted.
My button. Sorry, Daryl. Just to clarify, so firstly, I think that this is... I won't talk about that. I'll come back after Daryl. It's not fair to Button completely. I wasn't thinking that we were suggesting people would restate old financial statements. I was thinking that this was a transition adjustment that would be, for example, an adjustment to opening retained earnings to reflect what your retained earnings would have looked like, assuming these old hedges had stayed in place through the period.
Yeah.
Is that what you were thinking?
Yeah. Even within IFRS 9, you wouldn't restate your comparatives.
But also just to your point, Mira, I agree that this is, sort of unorthodox. We would never go back and reinstate hedges that's been discontinued. But in this case, the hedges that would be reinstated are only those that failed because they changed the hedge documentation as required by the reform. Mm-hmm. It's not because it failed because of other reasons. Yeah. And you should be able to show that is the reason it failed, and that you can bring it back without the use of hindsight. Mm-hmm. And the reason, I think the risk of having other hedges being reinstated is quite small, is that if the entities knew during, let's say, this year that the hedges are going to, they failed because of the changes to the hedge documentation, and now we came and we said, well, they wouldn't have failed. Those hedges really didn't fail from an economic or a risk management perspective. They only failed from an accounting perspective. So from a risk management and an economic perspective in the background, I think those hedges would have probably continued to run. And so bringing them back, you can do that without the use of hindsight because they are really still there running. And I also think that I don't disagree with limiting it to this year, but I think the risk for having hedges failed in 2019 because of changes to the hedge documentation is quite low, because back in 2019, everybody was adopting the phase one relief to stop the hedges from failing, so they haven't made changes to the hedges yet because they haven't been able to meet the criteria back in 2019. Mm-hmm. So I think the risk is quite small, but I get your point about...
I think I still would prefer to limit it, but I think Sue's distinction about restating previously issued, because we are saying retrospective, and I think we have to be very
clear
about that, because it's the comparative period, and that's the only way I would have read retrospective.
Okay. Daryl?
So I, at the start, would say I'm very comfortable with going backwards. I think it makes sense to say that, given the objectives of this project, we should be able to essentially treat our financial statements as though this phase two relief had been in place all the time. I think there's a certain logic to that. I'm very comfortable with. I think where I start getting slightly nervous, and I think probably the words that threw me in here were the hindsight reference, because what that suggests, my starting point in thinking about this is I have a defined population. It is hedges that I have previously identified and previously designated. There's a limitation on the defined on that group, because it is the ones that have failed in this particular period that I'm looking at, so I now know exactly which ones I'm considering. The difficulty is then, do I get into what feels like a choice? Now, when I read what we have required up to now, we said, no, it's not a choice. You mandated to apply the requirements as is. And so I'm now comfortable that I know exactly which contracts are going to change and which are not going to change. I worry about what the word hindsight is actually going to do in this circumstance. So how does the word hindsight come into play in allowing me to say, well, some are going to be reinstated and some are not? And right now I've got a defined thing that's happened. I can show it. It's part of my, let's say, 2020 financial statements. It's very clear what happened there. I can explain that and it'll be the same for everybody. When I come to the restatement, if there's any element of choice in that restatement, I start getting into how have I made those choices, how have I actually got to where I've got to.
So I suppose the big question for me is how are you thinking the words hindsight might apply here? And do you see that as becoming a real constraint? Or is this something that, given that we've now got this out here, it's covering a period that's still coming, that it's actually not likely to be a real constraint? People can start thinking about it now and should be able to apply this requirement to everything where it applies.
I would think it's more the latter. But and similarly, there are two criteria. The one is you have to be able to show that it is because of the changes. Now, if I really don't want to bring it back, you know, I might presumably all of a sudden not have any documentation to show that that's why it fails, and so I can still get out of, you know, if I really don't want to do it, then there is still a way to get out. So it's not the hindsight, I think, per se, that would result in some hedges not being able to be brought back. So I don't think the hindsight itself is putting any limitations or loopholes in.
So from time to time in other standards, we've essentially said that the clock starts ticking, if you like, on this from the date that the standard is published. So it's things that happen after that, and then you don't get into the hindsight trap. And I just wonder whether that might be a way of thinking about this particular one, because, as I say, my big concern here is I understand the problem we're trying to solve is to say we want the continuity of the hedging relationships. And I think I understand why losing that information is important. But my real concern is if we get into a choice space, I think that's even worse than the problem we're trying to solve.
I think that the points that Daryl's raising show why this is a huge concession. For me, this is the hugest concession the staff is asking us to give in this project, because I don't remember a situation where we've ever said you can go back and reinstate a hedge. It's sort of a holy cow in this building that you don't apply hedge accounting retrospectively, and you certainly don't go back and reinstate failed hedges. Having said all of that, I think that we do need to do it here, and the reason why I think we do need to do it is that even though we're moving as fast as we possibly can from a standard-setting perspective, and we've gone to, you know, I'm going to talk about it next, the comment period, we've gone to the Due Process Oversight Committee asking for a short comment period, we're going to, you know, we're doing everything we can to get this amendment done as quickly as we can. The reality is people are having to change stuff now, and they've already got a problem, and unless we allow this to be, require this to be applied retrospectively, haven't delivered a solution for, people who are trying to do the right thing. And so even though it makes me feel ill, and you highlight a lot of the reasons why I feel ill, because I worry of the risk of cherry-picking, I think we have to try and find a way to get this to work. So I support the staff recommendation, but from a signalling perspective, I think we should be making it clear that we're saying you're required to reinstate these hedges if they only stopped because of this issue. You're required to, and our expectation is hindsight shouldn't be an issue because you're on notice. Yes. That you're required to reinstate these hedges. And there should be more discipline. Usually what we're worried about is situations where people can cherry pick and there wasn't the normal documentation and in place. Here we've got a situation where until 5 minutes ago these people had hedge documentation, they're being audited, they're running all of the effectiveness testing, they've got all of the information there. I think they're crying because they want to be able to continue hedge accounting, and we're at the moment they've got a technical problem because of the requirements in our standard. We're coming along to facilitate. I would hope that they're listening to the meeting and they can keep running the numbers. Yeah. So they shouldn't have a hindsight problem. And so if we require them to reinstate these hedges and we make it clear on the basis that the expectation is, even though it should be subject to hindsight, shouldn't be a problem. We're only talking a short period of time as well, which is different to a lot of other situations. I think that's a way we can minimise the risk, but it doesn't make me feel... there is a tension between saying subject to hindsight and you have to do it.
Yep.
But I think we all have to hope that we're all going to be grown-ups working together to get a good answer for the market, but it's not without risk. Rika?
Thank you. I support staff's recommendation. I actually have still concern about creating the kind of the precedence of to allow this restatement of the discontinued hedge relationships. But still, this is just a very narrow situation we are discussing about. So one-time fixed issue in connection with the IBOR reform, And also, I truly think the condition proposed, recommended by staff on the paper, that's very critical to apply this recommended proposal. And so I really echo what Sue said. I think the BC should be clearly stated about what our expectation about how to meet those two criteria in practice.
Anne. Like Daryl, I was thinking about the choice that's implied, and the wording in the paper is permit, and now Sue's introduced the word require. So we're going to have to be clear what we're actually talking about. So my question is, already we have phase one, and so are we referring to hedges that are before phase one, or are these hedges that have been discontinued in phase one? Because my understanding was that our aim in phase one was to prevent this discontinuation of hedges that are only discontinuing because of IBOR reform. So I'm envisaging during phase one, we've got these hedges that are not, they aren't discontinuing. People are not being forced to discontinue because phase one's in place. So is this then relating to something that exists prior to phase one?
No, I think this is more something that happened between phase one and phase two. Mm-hmm. Because phase one said, well, you can assume your risks stay the same. But back in phase one, we didn't say what happened if you change the risk or if you change the contract. And so looking at the requirements in the standard, if somebody did change the hedge documentation to change the hedge risk, so they changed the designation of that hedge, that would have been discontinued. So it's sort of between phase one and phase two, in a way.
So we think it's a limited period, and we think it's a limited population, and we know what the defined time period is. So if we're going to say we require, we can actually put some boundaries around what it is we require, and then it applies to
people
everybody.
Who have actually made modifications to financial instruments or modified their hedging arrangements. Phase one just said, if you haven't changed your contracts yet, you can assume they're not going to change. So that's a different...
It's a different group of people. It's people they have had
the same entities but different circumstances.
Yeah, so they've had to discontinue certain contracts. So we can define the time period and the contracts to which this relates, and we can make it required. So it's very specific. It's not a choice. So it will avoid cherry picking.
We hope. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Question two.
So question two, can I get a show of hands on whether, so the transition requirements will be clear, it's required. Yeah. No, okay, with a show of hands.
13, one absent.
And question three.
Yeah, it's just quickly.
So on transition disclosures, as required by ISA, so for the reasons we lay out in paragraph 32 to 35 of the paper, the staff recommend that in the reporting period in which an entity first applies the proposed amendments, an entity is not required to present the disclosures required by paragraph 28F of IS 8. Question 3 then asks the board whether you agree with this staff recommendation.
One absent.
So for agenda paper 14E, sets out the two process steps that the board has taken in developing the proposed amendments and proposes a comment period for the exposure draft on the interest rate benchmark reform phase two. Considering the timeline to draft and ballot an exposure draft, redeliberate the proposals and finalize the amendments, the staff recommend a comment period of 45 days for the exposure draft. Given the narrow scope of the exposure draft and its intended outcome, we believe that such a comment period would still provide stakeholders with sufficient time to consider and comment on the proposals. The DPOC approval has been received in this regard. Appendix A to this paper sets out the due process steps taken in developing the proposed amendments based on the requirements of the due process handbook. In view of the steps that were taken, the staff believe that the board has complied with all the due process activities identified as being required in the due process handbook and therefore the staff would like to seek the board's permission to begin the balloting process for the exposure draft. We're just stopping for any comments. So the questions are, the staff would like to ask the board if it agrees with our recommendation to have a comment period of 45 days for the exposure draft of the proposed amendments.
Sorry, I just wanted to make one point. I do agree with the recommendation, but I wanted to just make one point which is really relevant for messaging as opposed to substance as such. So in paragraph 4 we talk about the narrow scope of the amendments, and I do agree that the focused nature of the amendments supports the 45-day comment period. I just think we need to be careful not to say that the exceptions only apply to modifications as we describe them here, because it also applies to modifications where you're changing eyeball but you're doing more, so it's not economically equivalent, and I don't want somebody to read paragraph 4 to say, well, I don't have to worry about this because I changed the term, I changed the margin, I did all this other stuff. It's not what you mean, but just to be pedantic. Period, so 45 days, question one.
13, one absent.
Does anybody intend to dissent?
Nobody.
And do you give the staff permission to begin the process for balloting the exposure draft?
13.
Thank you.
That's a wrap.
Yeah.
Well done. Into the washroom, I think. Thank you.